Chaver, again, welcome to conference call number 5 with Rabbi Willig. We are now about to begin. Thank you, Rabbi Willig.
Thank you very much. We have 5 questions today. You probably notice it will have to do with women. Let us begin question number 1, which is entitled Birth Control. Does a pill count as a veset kavua? If yes, does that mean that the woman would not have to observe a veset benonit? Does she need to wait 3 months to establish it, or does it take effect right away? How would small amounts of breakthrough bleeding before she goes on placebo affect this? That's part 1 of the question. We'll come back to B and C later on. There is a din of veset kavua. In this case, I believe yes. There is a dispute in the context of veses achilos. When a woman eats a sharp food, she sees her period, whether it has a status of veses kavua or not. Nyeredeya simen kuf pei tes sifchav gimel. It seems that pills are even more predictable, having been tried on millions upon millions of women, than the veses achilos. This is a note which is also found in the beautiful Sefer on Hilchos Nida by Rabbi Binyamin Forst, where he makes this remark. And as a result, yes, it is a veses kavua. Now, you talk about a veses benonis, you cannot be discussing the classical birth control pill. Those who know, the original pill was a 28-day pack to make it easier for people to go by the weeks and to approximate the monthly cycle. 21 days of an active pill. Then you go on a placebo, and the period starts shortly thereafter. Any woman who is on that kind of a pill will never get to veses benonis. She'll always see 4 weeks exactly after the last time. And therefore, since the owner benonis is the 30th day, we assume, so therefore it's never going to come to that. However, as we will discuss soon, there are those who extend. Let's say instead of having 21 actives followed by 7 placebos, she'll decide to do 28 actives followed by a placebo. So there you're already going to run into the owner benonis before she has her next period. It seems to me that yes, there would be a din of veses kavua, after which we do not have to worry about onah benonis or vesta chodesh for that matter. However, I believe it should be strict and wait till 3 times have elapsed that she has in fact not seen until the 35 days after the last period, just to make sure that she is a woman who is typically completely clean before the next period comes. And one of the reasons for this is that it's been demonstrated that the 28-day pack, when it works well, prevents any kind of breakthrough bleeding because the woman's body is used to having the lining shed every month or so. And if it's every 28 days, if once it's, you know, on a proper, an even keel, that's what happens. Once you go beyond that, breakthrough bleeding becomes a bit more common. And we should be very careful. When we say the word breakthrough bleeding, it has a connotation of you have a regular period, and somewhere in the middle is a breakthrough bleeding. Some women make a mistake. A pill typically reduces the output that a woman has every single month, often dramatically, and sometimes, with certain of the newer pills, to the point where almost nothing is seen. We spoke about it in a previous call, that there's an IUD called Mirena, which is comparable to that, and has what they call a tipach chit, a monthly drop, and I was of the opinion, and this is Rabbi Yosha's opinion, that one drop would constitute a nida de oraisa, even though it's only a small amount, because that is her period, given her new circumstance of she's being medicated with a pill. And therefore, the leniencies of small amounts or colored garments would not be effective. Unfortunately, there are some who don't realize that, and they're on pills, and they put on dark garments or dark pants, and they go on their merry way as if they're not in need at all, which I believe is incorrect. So we have to be very careful when we speak about breakthrough bleeding. I'm using the word breakthrough to mean there is a period, and this is a breakthrough over and above the period. But if the breakthrough is the period, I believe you have to be much more careful. And indeed, this leads us to B. What do I think about doubling a cycle, where a woman will skip a cycle of placebos so as to have 2 months between periods? So let's just do the arithmetic. Instead of 21 active pills and 7 placebos, she'll have 42 active pills and 7 placebos. Just won't use the first 7 placebos. That's a good question. I believe in strict halacha there's no prohibition whatsoever. Perhaps you have to be a bit more careful for this breakthrough bleeding, since there's a longer period of time between, that was a bad word to use, a longer span of time between the periods, and we have to be careful. I do believe that kind of a ratio, 42 actives and 7 placebos, which would yield, for the typical woman who's observing Taras HaMishpacha, a ratio which is within the realm of what the halacha has in mind. Let me explain. C says, what do I think about forms of birth control should obviate any periods in the future? I do not believe there's any official prohibition for it. You have to be even more careful about breakthrough. Some raise health concerns. And I have a problem based on the Gemara Masechta Nida on the Flamed Aleph from Beis, which the Gemara is very concerned about what it calls a rogil v'kotzba, which means in our language, familiarity breeds contempt. And therefore the Gemara says, why is a woman supposed to separate from her husband by Torah law for 7 days out of the 30 days of a month? So she should be apart from him. And we say in English, absence makes the heart grow fonder. As the Gemara puts it, Shtei chaviva al bala kish'as k'nisasa l'chupa. Nonetheless, the ratio of the Gemara, remember, is 7 days min HaTorah, 5:30. And that would be, if you had a pack, 23 and 7. But now we know there are at least 12 days of prohibition given our various minhagim and dinim and simon kuf tzad yivav. And therefore, the ratio is closer to 40 days. 40, not 23-7, but we'll call it 40-12. She's separate for 12 days. So if she's using a double pack, which is 42 and 7 in terms of the placebo, but it's really 42-12 in terms of the days that she has to be separated from her husband, and therefore it's close enough to the ratio of the Gemara. Beyond that, the seasonal, which is once every 3 months, and there's those who don't see at all, I can't prohibit it. We're not in the position to make our own prohibitions, but it seems to me that it's not wise, given the Torah's concern for the familiarity breed contempt issue, Ruggle the Kotzba, and given the Gemara's concern for Chaviva al-Bala Kishas Nisas al-Chupa, which is an important element of bettering a marriage. So I feel that if she wants to double it, that's still within range, but beyond that, I think is out of that range, and although it's not technically prohibited, it should be discouraged. This is question number one. By the way, question number one is by far the easiest question of all the five. Question number two, what's my position on having a female that is educated in halachas, for example, Hilchos Nida, to paskin on questions that women have, what would I say about passing on Maris? Is there a difference between different areas of halacha? And here we have what we call a she'elas chacham chati tshuva. The questioner has a half an answer. It seems from the Piskei Tshuva in Chosh Mishpat 7.5 that it would be permitted. However, there's a Sharei Tshuva, 4.61.17, that says it is not permitted for a woman to pasken. How do you reconcile this? Let's begin our answer with this reconciliation of these two apparently contradictory sources. I don't believe it's a contradiction. Actually, the Piskei Tshuva quotes the Sharei Tshuva. Doesn't say they're arguing. But let me explain as I can. Yes, a woman can pasken. The Piskei Tshuva quotes two sources to that effect. One is Devorah. Tosa says she was Melamedes Hasadinim. She taught the Dinim to Klal Yisrael. And the second, even more compelling, is the Sefer Achinuch, who says in the Ishtar of Shtuyayayim, that a Shikar al Yore, it applies to all men, and to a Chachama, Haru'uya, to Lahoros, there could be a female who is worthy and capable of issuing halachic decisions, and she may not do so under the influence of alcohol. So therefore the answer is yes, it certainly is a possibility. Obviously, Devorah was an exception ordained by Hashem, and the Chinuch is discussing the realm of possibility without discussing the world of practicality. The Sharei Tshuva quotes a phrase from a Tshuva Sefer that the Rebbe of Heschel, that's the Shach's Rebbe, the Gadol HaDor of Krakow, that he would be Moser to Bnei Beso, he'd give over to his family members, presumably his the female ones, to help him in the Paskin Shilas about whether something is Chometz or not Chometz. It's in Hilchos Pesach. So he writes over there, there's a footnote, some kind of a comment in the Sharei Tshuva, quote, Chas v'sholom shahagon moser haharol l'bnei beso. Chas v'sholom to say that the Gon Rav Heschel gave over the harol, the psak, to the female members of his household. So what did he do instead? Samach al devrayim be'esek harol azos. He relied upon the word in the establishing the facts which had to be considered before the psak was given. Why? Because women are more familiar with what's called their b'masei ofe in baking, and also in tarnagolim for hilchos treifos, and therefore we rely upon the women to clarify the facts, not to issue the psak itself. Therefore, there's no contradiction between the Piskei Tshuva and the Sharei Tshuva. The Piskei Tshuva says in theory that a woman is able to render a horah. Devorah did it. And if a woman did it under the influence of alcohol, she'd be in violation of Shikar al Yore. But in point of fact, he says, although the woman may be permitted to do so, the man, or the Rav, is not permitted, and he used the word Chas V'Shalom, not permitted to give over the prerogative of making these decisions to women. No contradiction. She may do it, but the man may not give to her questions which should be coming to him and turn it over to her. This is the way that the apparent contradiction can be reconciled. And therefore, I believe the take-home message going forward is, just as in those days we had Gedolei Olam, Rebbe Rav Heschel, none of us is even a millionth of the Rebbe Rav Heschel, he was not permitted to give over the Horah to his wife, who undoubtedly was a great woman in her own right. So too today, rabbis, we should say, Yiftach Bedoro Kishmu Bedoro, we're only small rabbis compared to the giants of the 17th century. But in our generation, the Rabbanim have a responsibility to fulfill their own mandate, their own tafkid of paskening shalos to the best of their ability. And if we may quote from the Sharei Tshuva, Chas V'Shalom, it should be passed over to Bnei Beso, be rebbetzins or daughters in one's own house, whether they be females from the outside, it should not be done. Remember, The Gemara tells the Masechta Avodah Zarah that if you test him at bait, on the pasuk of in Mishlei, Vatsumim Kol Harugeha, this is someone who's Higiyah Lahara Ve'ena Mora, someone who's able to give a psak and opt not to. That's a very serious problem to be in that situation, and therefore to give over this responsibility to Paskin Shilas to others, particularly the females, as quoted in the Shari Tshuva, seems to be a very, very serious problem. To give it over to a male is also not given over on a regular basis, unless, of course, the particular Rav finds someone who is a greater scholar, then he should always defer to someone who is greater than himself, and he can defer in many different ways. Someone asks you a shaila, you're not 100% sure, you call up a scholar of a greater level, with more scholarship and more experience, and ask him, and if it's necessary, you feel you're just not qualified to answer this whole area of halacha, you can be, how should we say it, moser the hora to that individual. In some shuls, there's a rabbi, and there's a dayan, and the rabbi is moser the hora over to the dayan, who specializes in giving psak. That's nothing wrong with that. Presumably the dayan would be more qualified in such a circumstance, and that is an ample precedent for such institutions. Now, the question is as follows. To whom does one moser, if you will, the hora? To someone who is the greatest Talmud Chacham, and that's measured as these things have been measured for since time immemorial by scholarship. In other words, how much Torah has the individual learned? How many years has he been involved in Psak Halacha? Is his grounding and his experience and his Mesorah in Psak firm and well recognized? These are very significant criteria in determining who, in fact, would be the best person to be most of the hurrah to for someone who feels not capable of doing it by himself. Of course, if it's a specialized area of halacha, over and above his general knowledge of shas and poskim and what we call darchei ha-hurrah and experience, etc., he has to have a specialty in a particular area. If he doesn't have it, you wouldn't want to ask him a question in that area. Hard to imagine, at least today for me, that a woman should be on such a level that you're required to be moser the hora to an isha chachama, even though a chachama is ruya lahoros in theory, as the chinuch said, but that the rabbi cannot paskin by himself and cannot find a capable rav to be most of the hara, to can only be most of the hara to a woman, and she's more capable than any of the men in terms of her knowledge of Torah and Shas and Poskim and Darche Hara and experience and Mesorah. In today's world, in 2014, at the present time, to me, that is not a reality. Not a reality. And, to answer the question, Hilchos Nida is no different than any other area of halacha in principle. And therefore, it seems inappropriate for rabbis to, quote, outsource the Nida questions to anybody else. Now, what is unique about Nida is that there are women who are embarrassed or say they're embarrassed to ask a shayla directly of a rav, even though, you know, they're not afraid to ask a shayla of a doctor. But okay, it's a somewhat different relationship. But it doesn't mean that she should not be receiving an answer from the Rav, who's best positioned to answer her, knowing her husband, knowing her circumstance. She does not want to speak to the Rav directly. There are two ways to go. Traditionally, either she asks her husband to ask the Shaila of the Rav, or she herself asks the Shaila of the Rebbetzin. So whether it goes around this way, goes around that way, the Shaila goes indirectly, if necessary, from the woman to the Rav, and he paskins the Shaila with the full knowledge of who he is and who she is, the couple, and he's known them for years, and he knows their circumstances, their temperaments, it's something that Shas HaTzchak, this he knows. And assuming he's capable in his psika in general, and he's had some grounding in Hilchos Nida, so he's the best person to answer the shaila. And if he doesn't know, he's best asking a question of someone who is greater than he in scholarship and receive the answer. But he, the one who knows the couple, should be the one to apply the scholarship that he's received from a greater authority to the particular case at hand. That is the way things always were done. That is the way things should be done going forward. Now, therefore, a woman, in theory, can know the halachas, no question about it. Women are very bright. They can sit with a Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Nida, and if they have sufficient skills, they can read it in the original. They can be taught in, either in translation or by instructors. And just as women have always learned the laws of Tara by themselves for their own marriages, and very often they had what we call today kala teachers being much more knowledgeable, well, the kala teacher can not only talk to a woman before she's married, so in theory, she can talk to the woman after she's married as well. Classical kala teachers knew their place. They're kala teachers. They're knowledgeable. They learned the halachas. They know how to explain it in a proper fashion. But they also understood that they were not Torah scholars. They did not have years of experience in the Beis Medrash. They didn't have a Mesorah of their own in Paskening, which they're getting from Rebbeim of the previous generation. And therefore, they knew. They knew that they were going to give over information as they had received it, and that any psak, which had to be rendered after the couple was married, would go to the Rav, the local Rav, presumably usually of the husband, was a connection to the, more of a connection to the Rav. And again, the woman would ask directly, or she'd ask through her husband, or through the Rebbetzin. That's how it always was. Today, and I'm sure the question is all about this without mentioning the actual word, there's a new concept called the Yoetzet. And that is a novelty which started some years back. And the official title, Yoetzet, literally means an advisor, was chosen with care, as opposed to we'll call a poseket, a woman who was rendering halachic decisions. I will give you a story, a particular Yoetzet, whom I know for many, many years, came knocking on my door once on a Shabbos afternoon. She was upset that she had come to our community as a scholar in residence, and a local rabbi introduced her as a poseket. And she said, she was nodding her head, no, I'm not a poseket, I'm only a yoetzet. I told her that, you know, you can portray yourself the way you would like to, but others will portray you the way they want to. And it's an unavoidable reality in today's world. We'll come back to that a little bit later. In any event, it's hard to draw a line, very, very hard to draw a line. What is yiyutz? What is halachic advice of a yoetzet? And what is psak? And what is a rendering of halachic decisions, even in some thorny matters? I know for a fact that there are many situations in which they quote yoetzet, crosses the line, and is giving what we'll call in our language psak. I'm not exactly sure how they were taught in their classes what is called yiyutz, what is called psak, but from my perspective, many have crossed that line, and I've received many questions, follow-up questions, after such lines were crossed, and, you know, in terms of what do you do going forward. Sometimes it gets very complicated. Many of the Yoetzot ask shilas before they give anything which resembles a psak. I myself have received many, many questions from various Yoetzot over the years. I try to answer them. Some are the same as by chachamim. There's some greater chachamim and some lesser chachamim. There's some greater chachamos and some lesser chachamos. That's life. But I do know, and this is another critical point over here, many, many questions raised that are asked to the Yoetzot are done so anonymously. Anonymous halacha has problems of its own. It's not an ideal. There should be a connection between the shoel and the nishol. There's a whole prima gadam, ha'anhoga shoel v'nishol. They didn't envision anonymous questions. Frankly, that's not good whether the person answering is male or female. anonymous is really not healthy. More than that, there are many who correspond to a yoetzet exclusively by email. So I also know from my interactions, email. Well, if you're ready emailing, you can email to anybody. Why must you email to a yoetzet? You can email to rabbanim. There are big rabbanim, myself not included. I'm not anywhere near that category. But there are big rabbanim who are active on email, and you can write to them and get a response back. The answer is, I have to say what I think is the truth, they want an answer from a female. It's not just a question of preserving their anonymity. It goes beyond that. They want the female voice, as it's sometimes called in today's world. And since we have individuals who have been trained, this is the way that many people want to go. This, of course, is not right. They should want the most educated and experienced opinion that they can receive. If they want to do it anonymously and are emailing yoetzet, they can also email rabbonim who have a greater and broader and deeper and more experienced knowledge, both bichlal in psak, in learning, in klalei hara, as well as in specific knowledge in these areas. Although, again, I wouldn't recommend that because of the anonymity involved. I'm against anonymity. But I'm saying if someone is hiding behind the mask of anonymity, that's why I have to speak to yoetzet. It's also not true. Not true. The proper way, as I said before, is to ask the Rav who knows the couple directly. And I've received many, many questions directly from women over the years in these shilas. You answer directly. You try to be like a doctor. You know, you have to, shouldn't be any different. And sometimes the psak depends a bit on the personal circumstances. Can't be done by somebody else, especially in Hilchos Tara. This is not ideal. All this that I said until now is what I'll call shonim kitikuna in the normal times. But it's impossible to analyze this issue in abstract. We know that in today's world there's a constant pushing of the envelope in these areas. Every chiddush begets a bolder chiddush, as we'll get to soon. And it's impossible, it's absolutely impossible to be oblivious to the egalitarian theme which is pervasive through all these various innovations that we see. Yes, we also have to look carefully at the innovators, not just innovations, but innovators, who they are, what is their connection, if any, to what we'll call the feminist movements, even those in the Orthodox community. Those who know the circumstances know that in our particular case of Yoetzot, that is a significant problem. I'm not discussing any particular Yoetzot. There are wonderful women. I assume they're all wonderful women, but there are many wonderful women who are serving as a Yoetzot who have nothing to do with what we'll call the Orthodox feminist movement or alliance or organization. But at the same time, one cannot be oblivious to the greater picture, what's happening out there, because everything is connected. One cannot judge a prat without looking at the klal. And this applies to my rabbinic colleagues, some of whom are in favor of this institution, and they mean well, for sure. But I have to look at the picture, both from the local problems, which I described earlier, the anonymity, and the trying to get the best answer from wherever it comes, on the one hand, and the broader and more global issue, on the other hand. At the same time, I believe it's very important that we give appropriate respect every person, every man, every woman, every rabbi, every yoetzet, everyone. We have to honor every single person because this is what we call kavod abrios. We have to be very, very careful. It's not appropriate to demean individuals. I think it's a very bad thing to do. I also want to have one cautionary note. I'm speaking as an American rav, In Eretz Yisrael, things may be a little bit different. Many people don't have a local rabbi. They daven in shtiblach, etc. But in the USA, I'm quite familiar with the situation. And I go back to the beginning, what the Shari Tshuva says, a rov should not be moser to Bnei Besa or to other women who are not smarter than Reb Heschel's wife. They should not be giving over the mahorah to them. If a woman on her own decides to ask a yoetzet, and yoetzet decides to answer a woman who's asking, that's their prerogative. They're doing what they're doing. But Rabbanim have their own, not only prerogative, but their own responsibility to do what he thinks is right. And if he thinks the right thing is to answer the questions himself, that is his responsibility, his obligation. And no one should be telling him different. Unfortunately, today, there is a campaign, I use the word advisedly, a campaign that rabbis and shuls should appoint yoatzot, and they're pressuring rabbis to do so, even if they don't really want to do so. Some are insisting on the status of a yoetzet or a salary for yoetzet. Those who know, there was a recent debate in a local Vada Rabbonim on this very point. One rabbi said it's an ethical problem because people are asking a yoetzet questions and they're not from the shul that is paying the yoetzet a salary. To which I respond, well, what about rabbis? I'm sure everybody on this call has received many questions from individuals who are not from his own congregation. I never heard anyone to raise an ethical problem about it. A rabbi gets paid by a shul, and beyond that is mani b'chinam. That's what it always was that way. And as a matter of fact, I'll end with this, a particular yoetzet from Eretz Yisrael, Talita, she should live a long and healthy life, without realizing it, I didn't know about this idea of, as she put it to me, status and salaries. She thought she just, you answer questions like anybody else. And she told me that because of some statement she made, there was pressure brought upon rabbis to accord status and salaries to yoetzot. She feels bad. She was very much repulsed by the feminist dimension of this campaign, which is not exactly what she had in mind. And I think I'm going to stop talking about this topic right now. Once again, this is not demeaning anybody. We respect everybody. We respect those who have different opinions. But it's not right that a rabbi should not be entitled to his own opinion in his own congregation to try to handle the shilas himself, as was done from time immemorial. And those who have a different way of handling things, that's their right. We can't take it away from them. Even if, as I explained to you before, it's a bidyeva from the strict perspective of hora, and it also runs into the broader problems which we discussed and which will be coming up again in the next questions. Question number 3. Would I please discuss the issue of girls wearing tefillin? Should we be speaking about it from the Bima? Okay. Here again, there's a technical issue and there's a broader issue. The Rambam writes in Siman Lamed Chesed Gimel, a woman who wants to put on tefillin is mochin biyodan. You have to protest against it. I believe the best child is the Aruch HaShulchan, who says that someone who is exempt should not be putting on tefillin. It requires a gufnaki, machshavat, nakia. If you are chayev, you have no alternative. That's why he explains we no longer give a cotton under my mitzvah, except maybe just a short period of time just to train. So should be able to put on properly when he turns 13. That's why we no longer wear tefillin all day, because we try to put on just at a minimum, because we're obligated. And since women are not obligated, they shouldn't be doing it. And that's why we should protest if they try to do it. To talk about it from the Bima, look, like anything else, depends upon the judgment of the local Rav, and he has to know his audience, he has to know the situation. The main problem over here, as I said before, is not the, we'll call the issue of tefillin, which is considerable, it's a meramah, it's an aruch ha-shulchan, but it's the, how should I say, the bold change against a tradition of thousands of years without proper endorsement. This is the main problem. Now, there are those who say, what do you mean? In the 20th century, there was a greater change, the change to introduce Jewish education. And that came from the women, came from Sarah Schneera. So here too, women want to put on tefillin. It's exactly the same thing. No, it's not the same thing for the following basic reason. When Sarah Schneera wanted to establish the Beis Yaakov, so she was from the Belzer Chassidim, so she went to the Belzer Rebbe, and the story, she went with her brother, and the brother was sure that the Rebbe would say no, and that all her plans would go up in smoke and would come to naught. Instead of saying no, he said two words, Mazel Lebrocha, which changed history, and then she then went to the Chofetz Chaim, the Gadol Hador, she went to the Ger Rebbe as well, and that's why, because the endorsement of three of the greatest giants of the generation, the Beis Yaakov movement succeeded, even though it was against the tradition of thousands of years. My understanding is the Rambam writes expression, Tzivu Chachamim, that it never was an absolute prohibition. It was an Atzas HaGemara, which we don't take lightly. We try to adhere to the advice of the Chachamim throughout the generations. And the Chofetz Chaim and others explain, in the Kutei Halachas he writes, that times have changed, and therefore a major revolution was, in fact, appropriate at that time in that time and place. Now, what that means is that if someone wants to put on tefillin, she should go to the greatest Chachmei Hador. I would say that years back, we go to Rabbi Moshe, go to Rabbi Yashiv, go to the Ger Rebbe, Belzer Rebbe. They're big Rabbanim today, and they're poskim as well, even in our Dor Yosom, and ask them what to do. But that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened. You have to worry about someone who is making something new, and it's not 100% lishma. You need lishma completely. I'll refer you to the Netziv in his Hamek Dover, Vayikra Perik Yudches Pasuk Hey, which is a contradiction in two Gemaras. One Gemara says in Psachim that someone who's Ostik B'Torah Mitzvah Shalol Lishma, B'Torah Shalol Lishma B'Torah Lishma is applauded. And there's a Oseh Shalol Lishma, the Gemara says, it's Noach Lo Shalom Nivra. So how can that be? Explains in the Tziv, no. It's Oseh. Oseh does not mean to engage in. Oseh means to create something new. Mechadesh B'Sichlo. Someone's creating something new, whether it be in Torah, a new Chiddush, or even more important in Mitzvahs, a new Hanhaga, cannot be done Shalol Lishma. Can only be done with a pure motivation. And that's what it means. Now, today, again, it's impossible to be oblivious to the fact that the initial push for women wearing tefillin came from non-Orthodox movements. That's just a reality. And therefore, when you introduce such a chiddush, it's, by definition, suspect. Be so careful what the motivation is. And again, I'm not speaking about any particular woman or any particular rabbi. I'm talking about the global picture. If you look in the Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Noso, a person shouldn't say, Eini Mekayim Mitzvahs Kenim. I'm not going to say Tchanik Alecht. It's not in the Torah. So you're not going to say that, says the Chazal. Why? Asisa Pia Torah She'erucha Dvarim Perik Yud. I agree to the words that Hashem says. Where do you find that? Yaakov Avinu blessed Menashe and Ephraim. Put Ephraim first. Where did Hashem endorse it? Chanukasa Hanesiim, where Ephraim was on the seventh day and Menashe was on the eighth day. Adkan, the Medrash Tanchuma. I understand this to mean as follows, a very deep lesson over here. Why they picked this particular Derabonan? There are many Derabonans. Why they picked this particular example of Ephraim and Menashe? There are many examples. I believe the answer is as follows. Why did, if you look again at another Netziv, in Bereishis, Perek Memches, Posuk, Yud, Dalit, he says that Ephraim and Menashe represented two separate types of leadership. Ephraim is in Torah. Rashi comments that Ephraim was the individual who was always with his father, B'Talmud, with his grandfather, rather, B'Talmud, with Yaakov Avinu. And Menashe was a court interpreter, Melitz Ben Osam, with respect to Yosef HaTzadik. So therefore, he put the right hand on Ephraim's head, because the head represents Torah, and he put his left hand, he put Menashe on his right foot, the foot being the most powerful organ, Balichas Olam Hoya Menashe Kodem Vegodol Me'Ephraim, writes in the Tiv. And that's, each one accentuates the positive. That's what he explains. That being the case, we can take it one step further and say, if you look in Rashi, Perek Memches Pasuk Yutes, that yes, Menashe will be great, Gidol will come from him, and Ephraim will be greater, because Yeshua will come from him, Shilam et Torah Yisrael. That's exactly the point, that Yeshua is the Torah leader, and Gidon is a warrior. But it's more than that. It's more than that. When we analyze Torah leadership versus worldly leadership, it's completely opposites. In worldly leadership, they have to be ahead of the curve. There are always new developments in the military world, the diplomatic world, always things which are new. Forget the old and bring in the new. In Torah, it's exactly the reverse. In Torah, you're supposed to go back to what we call the old-time religion and to be as close as you possibly can to the Matan Torah, the Sinai. That's exactly why we find that Gideon, who was a military man, was an innovator. Lech b'chochacho zev oshad es Yisrael. He innovated what we call today in modern warfare the Davidka. He had a lot of sound and light with his pitchers, with his chauffeurs, with his lanterns, and he fooled the enemy and he was able to be victorious. If he tried it again, it wouldn't work because they would report about it. It was a bluff. You can't do it twice. Always have to have a new strategy. You have to be ahead of the curve. Contrast this with Yehoshua. Pnei Moshe k'pnei Chama. Pnei Yehoshua k'pnei Levana. So every Torah scholar is supposed to reflect the glory of the previous Gadol from the previous generation. Two different mindsets completely. If you think about it more carefully, the very names Ephraim and Menashe indicate that. Ephraim is Lashon Hifrani, Lashon Pri. A fruit is the same as the original fruit in Gan Eden. Whereas Menashe, Ki Nashani Elokim, as Kol Amoliv, as Kol Beis Avi, Nashani means to forget, Nashani means to move. We're always moving on. So the Medrash Tanchuma chose this particular example to teach us this lesson. That generally speaking, in the Torah world, we're here to preserve what came before. If such an individual who is so devoted to preserving Torah Kedosha, and he decides there has to be a Chiddush, Yaakov put Ephraim before Menashe, Hashem responds, I agree. Chazal decides to make a Chiddush, institute Ner Chanukah, Hashem decides, I agree. But it's only someone whose main focus in life is the preservation of what came before, so every once in a while, a preservation may require an innovation. But it has to be based on someone whose Torah v'Yerushalayim, the Mesorah, is beyond reproach. That is his whole attitude towards life. And then once in a while, there could be a Chiddush, as the Medrash says. Unfortunately, in today's world, it's simply not that way. There's so many chidushim, one and another and another and another. Three of them are on today's agenda. So people are being mechadesh today, if I may use the expression, l'ruach hazman, to fit in with the zeitgeist, with the feminism and the egalitarianism. And that's to be so, so, so careful. Not the same at all as the Beis Yaakov that was founded with the blessing of the Chofetz Chaim and two of the greatest rebbes. Now, it is true that there can be minority views in every generation, and the followers of those giants who are in the minority are rewarded, as the Gemara tells us in Perek Rabbi Elazar de Mila, at the beginning, that in his town they were what we would call Mechal Shabbos for the purpose of Mila, and they were rewarded. The Romans shut down Mila except for their towns. But that's only Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar was from the Chachmei Hador. Everyone who opposed him understood that. They knew how great he was in Torah and Yerushalayim. And then they were able to follow him as their local Orthodox rabbi. Unfortunately, in today's world, that seems to have been forgotten. I haven't found any equivalent of even of a Rabbi Elazar in our door who was behind this idea of women wearing tefillin. As we saw before in the Medrash, Fasisap, based on the Pasuk in Parashat Shoftim, Fasisap Ya Torah Sheyarucha, If you look in the Sefer HaChinuch and Parashat Shoftim, he says it applies in all generations. How can it apply? We no longer have Sanhedrin. The answer is we have to follow the the scholars of the generation. If a scholar is in the minority, you may follow him, but he has to have credentials as a scholar, which even those who oppose him recognize. I do not believe that's true in this particular case. It's part of one of the mantras of today of bottom-up halacha. Now, bottom-up suggestions, they're always, you know, you can always listen to suggestions. But bottom-up psak halacha, no. It is really top-down, that which the people are complaining about. That's always the way it's always been in halacha. You go to the Chafetz Chaim, the big rebbes, before you want to innovate, and that's not being done. And therefore, this problem with the tefillin, aside from the purely technical problems of the Ramon Aruch HaShulchan, which are significant, but also as a more general problem, then no one knows where this is taking us. And therefore, when the Ramon says, Yesh Limchos, we should protest, referring to the local issues, because of the Gufnaki, Machshava, Tahora problem, as the Aruch HaShulchan explains, one who is not obligated should not be getting involved. But today, I believe, the Yesh Limchos should be directed primarily to the more global issue, which we discussed and we'll still discuss in the last question. Okay, question number four. An out-of-town rabbi has a problem with tefillin. He can take a stand as a rav, but it's bored in the community school. Unfortunately, I cannot answer this question. I do not know the circumstances. But one thing is true. This proves what I said before, that there is pressure for rabbis to allow girls to put on tefillin. It's hard to imagine they're doing it for the sake of a mitzvah. There's so many other mitzvahs that are not being, you don't find this pressure on the rabbi to make sure that the boys are wearing tzitzis, or pressure to make sure that they're not saying lashon hara, or they're benching a davening problem. There's no pressure. But there's pressure over here because you want to be from the mischachim, from the innovators. So that's a very dangerous situation, as I said earlier. Last question. Some members of my shul board have approached me to announce an all-women's Megillah reading taking place Purim night in the congregant's home. The group is a mixture of what I consider very sincere women and women who have challenged the status quo, wanting to promote a more liberal agenda. I was not consulted about this Megillah reading, but the pressure is building both ways, means to announce it or not to announce it, in the shul. Can I guide this man on what to do? Once again, as we said before, Lo hayu dvarei me'olam. There never were official women's Megillah ladings, just by the women, for the women. It never existed. And all of a sudden, they're demanding that the rabbi announce it in the shul. Now, the Mishnah Berurah, Siman Tav Reish Pei Tes, of Kotan Ches, quotes that a woman should not read the Megillah even for herself, and certainly not for other women. It's based upon a Zohar. But again, I'm not going to hide behind the Zohar. The Zohar is quoted by the Mishnah Berurah. That's true. That is a problem. We try not to go against the explicit Mishnah Berurahs. But again, the main problem is the bold innovation without the kind of support which we found with respect to innovations in previous times. I never heard the Chafetz Chaim or the big rebbes or their equivalents today to be in favor of women's Megillah reading. I have to tell you from my own local experience, and I happen to live in a community which seems to be the epicenter of many of these questions. They started a Megillah service by women for women, and before it turned around, it was by women for men. That's a much more serious, purely halachic issue. The Shulchan Aruch quotes there in Siman Tav Reish Pei Tes, two opinions on this matter. According to the Baal Halachas Gedolos, a woman who reads the Megillah, a man who hears from her cannot be yotzei his full obligation. We never heard of a minute to go against that Baal Halachas Gedolos. Ramah sounds in that siman that the woman is chayv only in shmiya, not in kriya, could even affect the bracha. And you know, something similar happened with respect to women's aliyahs. Same exact thing happened. Now there are these partnership minyanim where the women are getting aliyahs. Where did it come from? Because 30 years ago, they started, or more, that women should have their own women's tefillah with their own kriyas haTorah. And I was one of the signatories nearly 30 years ago protesting this. And one of the reasons was that it would lead to further results which are non-halachic, and that certainly happened. Initially, they didn't make brachos in the women's tefillah, and they started making brachos. Now they have the partnership minyanim. It seems to me, just to summarize, because we're running out of time, that all of the above-mentioned changes are connected to one another. I'm not equating them. I'm not equating them al pi ikar hadin, nor am I equating them in terms of how serious a breach they represent in previous Misora, in terms of ritual, in terms of learning and teaching, etc. Every Rav in every time and every place has to weigh carefully how to relate to these new phenomena. Once again, I want to reiterate, I believe it should be done without demeaning anybody, without casting aspersions on individuals or groups, but at the same time, a Rav is not only entitled, a Rav is required to take a firm stand if he believes that the stand is called for, that these innovations have their respective technical problems, which are significant, but also, especially collectively, given what's happening in the world around us, represent what I'll call an egalitarian push, which wishes to obviate all non-anatomical distinctions between men and women. Yes, I can see that the Orthodox ones will not do it if it goes against an explicit and unambiguous halacha, and they deserve credit for that because some of their more liberal sisters are not happy with that, and we're not going to go into that right now. So they do deserve credit for that, but at the same time, it's impossible to discuss any of these individual issues, anyone on its own, without looking at the greater picture. Impossible. And therefore, how should I say, time will tell. Time will tell. Will these new phenomena cause what's called a schism, a word that's been bandied about, and especially in the context of this partnership minyanim? Will it have an official schism? I don't know. I am not a prognosticator. I don't know. I have no idea how far people are going to go with additional innovations for the purpose of egalitarianism. I don't know. Just don't know. How far will they go with what we'll call female rabbis by whatever name they go? And where I come from, there were at least three. But is it just, you know, on and on and on and on? So what should we be doing? What should be our response to all of this? My advice is that our responsibility is to strengthen ourselves and strengthen our communities in a positive sense. In a positive sense, we want to make sure that our communities are strong in their Shemiras HaMitzvahs, are strong in the Limud HaTorah, are strong in their appreciation of what a proper Mesorah is, what a proper Rav is, what a proper Balabos is, what a proper Bas Yisrael and an Eish Hayil is. These are critical lessons which have to be taught positively and proactively, because being on the defensive on a regular basis is not a healthy situation. Yes, when there are particular phenomena which we feel are inappropriate, if you feel that way, you should speak your mind and say it in the nicest possible way, but don't focus on being a negative person. That's no good. If the rabbi is portrayed as it's only negative. He says no, no, and no. We should be trying to portray a more positive picture, what the Mesorah stands for, what Torah stands for, what Pesach stands for, what Shemiras HaMitzvah stands for, what Chesed stands for, what a Jewish family stands for, what every person's role is in that family, a man and a woman and a child, and the dangers of succumbing to the various isms of the outside world and how they've had a very disastrous impact on Klal Yisrael in the past. And it's just not wise to cater to every whim of outside society. They have to be evaluated very, very carefully. Sometimes the Rabbanim will respond to what we'll call a reality, as the Chafetz Chaim did. It was a reality that women were getting married later, were no longer in the house. That's a reality. And they were not empowered to change that reality. It was based upon World War I and other historical factors. And we can't change reality either. We're not bigger than the Chafetz Chaim. But reality is one thing, and the fact that people are pushing for something is another thing. It doesn't mean it's a reality. There are many wonderful communities where these innovations have not been accepted, and the Rabbonim have held their ground, and you know, life goes on. One's able to live in a more traditional fashion. So I hope and pray that we'll all try our best to have many positive activities in our shuls of Torah, of Tefillah, of Chesed, of Emunah, proper Hashkafa, of teaching every Ben Yisrael and Bas Yisrael the respective roles and responsibilities. And I have a bracha to each and every one of you, Shibi Matzliach, and your holy work. And in that schus, you will be successful as stewards of the Mesorah in your respective communities. And that Klal Yisrael as a whole will remain loyal to the Mesorah. Ad bias agol b'mher of Yemeinu Amen. Rabbi, I'm finished.
Rabbi, thank you very much. Amen. We agree to that beautiful bracha, and we thank you for your time to share with us this, and I'm sure we're all going to think very strongly about everything that was said. If we can we invite you back in 2 weeks on the 26th of February to go another round with us, if possible.
If people after today's shiur are still willing to hear me, I'm still willing to speak.
Bezrat Hashem, thank you very much.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Take care, everybody.
Bye. Bye-bye. Bye.